And so today we've got a great call with Dr. John Maluski, who's a multi-credentialed and has... Well, look, I gave a whole bunch of John's bio on the Ormus lists, and so I won't go through that too much. Needless to say, he's quite extraordinary researcher, scientist, developer, and inventor. And so without much further ado, I'm just going to welcome Dr. John to the call. And so settle in. Hope you got a nice cup of tea. Put your feet up and have a great listen, because in around about a little while, I'm going to call for questions, and I want you to take some serious notes as to what questions you have, and don't ask them until we go into question time, and then don't forget to write down these questions, because some of the stuff that John will talk about will bother your head so much that you might forget your last question. So write them down as you get them, and give them to us at question time. So listen, before we go through any further, I'd like to welcome Dr. Maluski to the call, buddy. Come right on and tell us about yourself.
Where you are.
And launch right into it.
Hello. Anybody new in there? If not, I'm going to start my song and dance.
Susanna.
Hello. Okay.
This is Richard Fox in here.
Oh, Richard. How you doing, Richard? John here.
Hey, John.
Good deal. All right. Look, I'm going to start my song and dance now, if it's okay with you. This is... I'm not a chemical alchemist, I'm an energy alchemist. And so I haven't done anything like the Red Lion or the Green Lion or any of those things. I've not done any chemical thing, but I've been making Ormus materials by high temperature processes in the microwave and melting in my liquid is liquid glass rather than liquid water that I'm working in. And so if you have questions relating to liquid chemistry, like wet processes, I'm not an expert in that, but if you want to question some of the ideas of how I made gold and some of these other materials and how I made Ormus material, that's right online. I'll explain exactly what I did and how I did it and make things available to you how you could, if you can, take what work I did and go a little further with it. And the main theme of my whole research is magnetic energy, and the theme behind that is superlight, which is magnetoelectric energy. And I'm going to take a few minutes to explain what I believe that is, because all the work that we're doing, whether it's magnetic water, magnetic monopoles, making gold, growing gold, and these atomic transformations that take place at room temperature, where does the energy come from? It comes from magnetic energy, which comes from super light. So if I explain a little bit what I believe super light is, then you might understand where I'm coming from on this here. You know, everybody knows what regular light is. It's electromagnetic radiation, and it's formed when an electron drops down in orbit from one level to another, and it radiates electromagnetic energy. But superlight is magnetoelectric energy, and that's formed from the movement and change of energy states of magnetic monopoles. And we'll talk more about magnetic monopoles later on, because I think that's the key to a lot of these transformation processes. The energy of a magnetic monopole, I believe, is about 10 billion times out of an electron. So we're talking with energies that are way out there, and we're just on a fringe of all that stuff. And that's where this tremendous amount of energy comes from to make these room temperature transformations. It's come from superlight energy and the release of magnetic monopoles. So superlight is...
John, so...
Yes,
so
is it coming through okay?
Everything's going great.
Okay.
I just want to remind you that if there's a beep, while you're speaking,
that
will obscure what you just said, so repeat it, please.
It'll what will it do? It might knock out what I just...
what you just said, mate.
Okay. It might knock it out. I mean, if somebody's coming in or something.
Right.
So I'll repeat that, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So the super light, where magnetic light, is the unseen force in nature. And if you look, I emailed to Barry four or five of my websites, and if you could download those websites, you'll see the one on super light, one on magnetic water, one on Ormus as a gas, and one on magnetic monopoles and plant growth. So you could get more of the detail of what I'm giving you now. I hope to be able to give you enough to stimulate your ideas to go into these websites and read and study this stuff, and then come back and call me or talk to me about this stuff and see where we could go even further. So this is super light. We live in a sea of energy. And a lot of people for thousands of years gave it different names like nuos or chi or biomagnetic energy, Wilhelm Reich's organ energy, Tesla's free energy, animal magnetism, vacuum energy and zero-point energy. But none of those things tell you what it is, but I say superlight is magnetoelectric. Once you know it's a magnetic energy and you know what form it's in, you have a much better chance of working with it. Calling it zero-point doesn't tell you how to capture it. But if it's magnetic energy, you know you want to work with something that works with magnetic energy. And this stuff solves it. It showed up about 100 years ago when Maxwell solved the wave equation. There were two solutions to his wave equation. The first solution was electromagnetic radiation, which is Michelson. And for 100 years, no one ever put negative numbers into Maxwell's equation. Any good, sound mathematical equation has just as valid with negative numbers as positive numbers. So you put negative numbers into Maxwell's equation, you come out, instead of electromagnetic radiation, you come out with magnetoelectric energy. Instead of traveling at the speed of light, you travel 10 billion times faster than the speed of light. Instead of coming, regular light or radiation comes from an antenna and it travels out from the antenna in all directions at the speed of light, and it's mostly electric energy with a magnetic component. Superlight is just the opposite. It travels into the antenna, traveling 10 billion times faster than the speed of light, and it's mostly magnetic in nature. And it's this magnetic energy and it's superlight energy that fills the universe and accounts for this dark matter or the missing mass of the universe. This is my theory. You know, I might be wrong in this, but it fits and solves a lot of equations, a lot of problems here, especially in physics and in astronomy. You could get that out of the later on. That superlight is responsible for gravity. Gravity is a push. It's a radiant pressure of superlight coming into us from all directions. A typical superlight is generated in black holes. That's where it comes from. When black hole temperatures gets up to 100 million degrees, you reach a critical mass, and then these magnetic monopoles, as they change energy states, they radiate light. And so black holes are actually radiant beings of superlight, magnetoelectric energy, and they escape the black hole very easily because they're traveling billions of times faster than the speed of light. And so this is what fills the whole universe with all these materials. And so it's responsible for gravity and in inertia are not intrinsic properties of matter. They are the reaction of matter into this in this field of superlight, this field of energy. We live in a dynamic ether, not a static ether, which Michelson and Morley tried to identify years ago. And also, you'll read in my paper later on, superlight accounts for the nuclear forces, accounts for all forces. And I won't go into more detail on that, but it's the energy of the universe and explains all forces in nature. So we're talking about Ormus materials. Ormus materials get their unusual properties by, you know, everyone knows the outer electrons become Meissner fields and become diamagnetic. So you got a magnetic field associated with each Ormus material. And so that magnetic field can interact with another magnetic field. There's no shield for magnetic fields. There's either concentrators, which are like magnetite, or there are things that interact either positive or another magnetic field is the only thing that reacts with a magnetic field. So this is superlight reacts with these Ormus materials and activates them things. And I believe it's the Ormus materials that are captured in plants that give these herbs materials different properties. Why aloe vera plant contains rhodium and iridium, and it's very good. It reacts the rhodium and iridium in the Ormus form in these plants are very helpful for people who are getting Alzheimer's because, as Hudson said and a lot of the other people, the brain contains rhodium and iridium. And what happens with people getting Alzheimer's, once the people say, is that the aluminum replaces the rhodium and iridium when it runs short. So if you keep your brain full of rhodium and iridium, make sure you drink enough aloe vera and other vegetables that contain that, you're going to be okay. And so superlight interacts with all of this stuff in our physical body and our spiritual body and everything else. Now, I'm going to make another little statement here. I'm going to let the superlight business go for a while, but let's think about why this magnetic energy is so important to us. Because, you know, we're electrical in nature. And so when you eat your Wheaties and you flex your muscles, electrons jump back and forth and your muscles move. But our spirit, I believe our spirit is magnetic in nature. And what we need to do is have a Starbucks for the soul. We need magnetic energy coming in. That's what my latest term Well, my magnetic water is called Starbucks for the soul. It's energy going directly into the spirit. And some of the extra aspects that you get from drinking magnetic water, eating these Ormus materials, is not only that you're starting to look and feel a little younger and healthier like that, which it shows up in your hair color changing, but also your intuition, your creativity, all the aspects of the spirit are activated by this material. And so it's another step forward here in my... I'm looking for my notes. I got myself covered all over the place here. So some of the things I'm going to talk about, first thing is, you know, I worked with Barry earlier in making these magnetic vortex things, you know, the rotating water over a magnet, you know, and drank that material. I think I got enough
intuition.
Yes?
John?
Yes?
Can we just ask everybody to mute out their line so we can hear you better?
Oh, okay, sure. Take your time to do that. You know,
and the way you do that is by hitting star 6, in case you don't know, and hit star 7 when you want to speak.
When you want to speak back, yeah. Okay. Is this coming through okay?
You're doing good.
You're loud and clear, buddy.
It's coming through clear. Okay. Well, I'll continue my song and dance here. So we just finished saying that the soul is and the spirit is magnetic in nature and the body is electrical in nature. So what we want to do is to enhance our beingness, not only in the physical body, going down to the exercise thing and eating our Wheaties, but we want to get more of this magnetic energy. And that's what I think Ormus does, whether you drink it in water or you make your own powder and these different aspects in which we're getting that energy into our spirit. So my first introduction to this was working with Barry on trying to make these magnetic vortex generators where you had the water swirling in a vortex over the magnet. And I was make that, and I worked with Barry and set up that one website. And Barry's got a website on how to make this magnetic water, and I took the pictures and I worked with him on that. But drinking that water, I think, inspired me. So when my wife said, look, John, you can't waste 100 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of happy juice, that's a sin against Mother Nature. Find another way to make your magnetic water. And maybe my inspiration from that gave me the idea that why don't I try making magnetic water by using magnetite, which I have a lot of it around my neighborhood, and putting that around concentrate the Earth's magnetic field. Because apparently it was this magnetic energy that was activating the water. So that was my transition, why I transferred from the vortex water to the magnetic mono, to the your magnetite water situation. And that's where that came from. And, of course, I'm selling and pushing magnetite all over the place. Just send some of it to Norway, and already sent some in the past to New Zealand and to Japan and to Israel and places all over the world. And people call me up and they ask about it. First thing I said, do you have any granite mountains nearby? Maybe you could get your own. If you can't get and find your own magnetite, I'll sell it to you. I don't want to be in the business of making and selling, of pushing magnetite, because I want to work on my magnetic motors and magnetic energy systems, which I'll get into a little bit why it's so important that before 2012 we have magnetic energy. And so we went from the magnetic water to the thing, and then I started working with that magnetic water. I started putting it on my plants. Not only was I drinking it, but I put the magnetic water on my wife's geraniums and within geranium. And there's a website on that, the fourth one down there. And also her nasturtium plants. Nasturtiums normally have a leaf an inch and a half in diameter, and the vines are 6 to 8 inches long. They're beautiful little cluster of plants. But when I planted them in the garden that had the magnetite in the soil, the nasturtiums, the leaves grew 5 inches to 6 inches in diameter. The vines were 5 to 7 feet tall. They were climbing up the trees all over the place. So this was a significant increase in the plant growth just by putting magnetite in the soil or putting magnetic water on the plant. My geranium was watered once a week with magnetic water, and the nasturtium plants were in a garden that which has had magnetite sprinkled on the surface. So it stimulates. And then I started thinking, how does this work? And then I was listening to this work, and if anyone hasn't read the book from Phil Callahan, you should get this book, Ancient Mysteries and Modern Visions, by Philip S. Callahan. And in chapter 3, 4, and 5, 9, 10, and 11, he talks about magnetic monopoles, and this guy should have won the Nobel Prize years ago, on this 20 years ago. He was the first one to detect magnetic monopoles using plants as a sensing device. And he claims that You know, if you take a standard bar magnet and break it in half, you don't have a north and a south pole. There might, whatever you break it, a new south pole forms or a new north pole forms. You don't have enough energy in your normal hands and pulling these things apart. But Callahan says that when the sun emits magnetic dipoles, which it's doing all the time as part of its radiation process, sorting out all kinds of particles, when a magnetic dipole goes through a solar flare where the temperature is up to 100 million degrees, there's enough energy to spread them apart. Now you got north magnetic monopoles and south magnetic monopoles streaming at the Earth. He says the south ones go into the stones and the soils, and the north ones goes into the leaves and the branches. And it's the recombination of these things that stimulate the photosynthesis process. So when you put magnetite on the soil or magnetic water in the soil, it brings in more south magnetic monopoles, which he says go through the roots and go up through the roots like waveguides and combine in the leaves. And when those, the north and south magnetic monopoles combine, they release a tremendous amount of energy, which is quickly gathered up and stored in the chlorophyll molecule, which is a large resin structure, and releases to the plant the energy needed to break up the water molecules and the carbon dioxide. Now, if any of you guys took biology in high school, when you studied photosynthesis, the number one thing was, this is still a mystery. We can't understand how the plant could take this water and break it up and break down carbon dioxide, because we know there's not enough energy in the sun to break up water because the sun is shining on the oceans all the time and it doesn't disappear. So the plant is getting additional energy from someplace. And where is it coming from? My contention, or my theory is, it's coming from the recombination of magnetic monopoles. And by putting magnetite in the soil, we stimulate more magnetic monopoles, and our plants go bananas, and they grow 9 feet tall. They grow from 1.5 inches to 5 inches in diameter leaves. They just grow like mad because it's stimulating that photosynthesis process. Now, another thing that's very interesting for us human beings is we're not plants. But, you know, anyone that looks at the chemistry of chlorophyll, which is in the plant, and look at the chemistry of hemoglobin, which is in our blood, the hemoglobin and the chemistry both and the chlorophyll are the porphyrin molecules, which are almost identical in structure. They're large 20 or 30 ring structures that have ability to store and resonate large amounts of energy. And so when you drink this water or you take this ornaments material that gets into your system, I'm sure a lot of that energy is stored into the blood and circulated around and given to your hair, your bones, your makes, and that is released. That energy is released to the healing where it's needed or regeneration where it's needed. And so it's the porphyrin molecule, which is almost identical with the chlorophyll and the hemoglobin, that gets resonated and activated by ornaments materials or magnetic monopoles because they carry this magnetic energy into this thing here. Now, let me talk a little bit about some of my growing gold and other materials, things like this, because this is real, I think, sort of like alchemy to me. And in 1998-99, for two years there, let me get back in the saddle here again. All right, so for 40 years, my business has been in crystal growth. You'll see that on my website on that thing. I'm working with high-temperature furnaces, working at high-temperature chemistry. I'm talking about interaction of silicon monoxide gas and methane gas and development, growing silicon carbide fibers or hafnium carbide as silicon nitride, aluminum oxide, sapphire whiskers, and things like this. I'm used to this high-temperature chemistry and working with high-temperature furnaces and stuff, and that's been my experience for 40 years in crystal growth and stuff. And so I had these furnaces, and we were talking about, Hudson says that this ornaments material is all over the place. And so I said, well, you know, it's probably in glass, too. He says, the quartz contains gold. And, of course, what I found out, that the black sands contain platinum and gold. One type of black sands, other type of black sands contain rhodium and iridium. And I'll tell you about how I recently made some of that stuff. Very spooky experiment. And so let's get back to the gold, because that was first. So I took this glass and I put it in a crucible, about 3-inch high crucible, and I filled it with insulation on the bottom and I put the glass on top. I put a layer of aluminum oxide so that the glass would melt down into that layer, So I had took 10, 15 grams of glass. This is container glass. Typically, you go buy coffee in a glass, in jar, and you pour the coffee out, or let your wife drink it up and eat it up, and take the glass and grind it up and put this fine powder on top of this crucible. And first I did is I tried to heat it in the microwave. It won't heat by itself when it's cold. So I put that whole unit in a regular kiln and got it hot. Once I get it hot, then I put it in a microwave and I surround it with insulation material like a nice Fiberfax, which is 2-inch thick pieces of glass. A Fiberfax is a lightweight packing of fibers. Very good insulation. It'll take up to 1,500 degrees C or 1,400 degrees C. Cut a hole in it big enough to put the crucible. Then you put that in the microwave. Now this will heat right on up. And to measure the temperature, I cut a little hole in the insulation. I had about a quarter-inch hole, and I had an optical pyrometer. And I would turn that thing microwave on and open the door every once in a while and take a reading through that little hole and look at the light go from red to orange to yellow. When it gets to yellow heat, you're around 1,100 degrees centigrade. You try to hold it there for a little while, and I pull it out, and I found after repeated cycles, and then this is some of the key things I wanted to tell you guys, in alchemy, repeat, given it, repeated cycles, we started to see...
How many times did you have to repeat?
About three or four times, the first few times. And so because, well, it is, I was plotting the temperature going up, and it was hard to hold it, and then and I'd say, well, gee, look, instead of being clear glass, first the glass is when you melt it, it's clear. And the second time, it goes from clear to brown. Like a transparent brown, not as dark as a beer bottle, but a slightly brownish glass. And then after the next cycle, you start to see little blue and white like veils, like smoke in the molten glass. So I'd pull them out, look at them each time, and we'd put them back in. And then eventually the white material, first it was blue, and then it went white, and then it went brown, and then we started to see the beads of gold. And those are beads of gold you can see in the pictures on that website of mine that Ormus is a gas. And those are the exact pictures I took of myself through a 20X microscope with a regular reflex camera. Hold it. When you want to take pictures through a microscope, you set your camera at infinity and have one of these look-through cameras, and you can focus it by looking right through the camera, get it focused right, and you take your pictures. And if you're just using a reflex camera, use the 800 film, and you need about 2 or 3 seconds. If you hold it steady long enough for 2 or 3 seconds, you can get this pretty good exposure. And you get these beautiful colors. And the reason you see the blue, first, when the Ormus powder is first forming, the particles are so small that they only reflect the blue wavelengths. That's what they call the Tyndall effect. That's why the sky is blue. The finest particles of dust stay way up in the air, and they reflect back only the blue light. The red light goes past them, And so we get blue, and then as the particles get larger, they coalesce into larger pieces. They start reflecting white light. And then as you activate it more in the furnace, you start to see the white turning to brown. And then all at once the brown clusters into these little beads, and these beads pop up to the surface. Now, this was a mystery to me. Why does gold, which is so much heavier than molten glass, stay on the surface and not drop down to the bottom of the glass? The glass was thick enough for 3 or 4 bead diameters. It was near the surface, mostly heavy. So a friend of mine, he says, well, when the microwaves are moving back and forth through that glass, they're shuttling back and forth, they're pushing everything up out of the way. And so the glass floats on the surface, and we pull that out. Now, the time that we first did that, the first day, we made 4 runs after repeated cycles. We got gold every time. And the total number of samples that we have that we broke out of this thing and sampled, we got about 40 or 50 pieces, about a quarter inch by quarter inch, that have gold beads in them, anywhere from 50 to 500 microns in diameter, half a millimeter. And the next day we tried to do it, we only got it 2 or 3 times, and by the end of the week we didn't do it anymore. And so, but what it is, when we were playing with these microwaves, this is the first time we were using microwaves that go in such high temperatures. We burned out 2 or 3 microwaves. What happens is when things get hot, they suscept more, and the more they suscept, the harder to get. The more they suscept, and before you know it, they run away, and you have a puddle on the bottom of your microwave, and it eats a hole right through the whole thing. So once your sample gets up to being red, no, not red, but you want to go from red to orange. When you get between the orange and the yellow heat, which is between 1,000 and 1,100 centigrade, then you want to crank down the power on your microwave to try to hold it steady. And that was one of the things we found. Once you form the gold, we say, oh, we found gold on this one. Let's put it back in and cook it some more and get more gold. We put it back in and cooked it some more, got it too hot, the gold disappeared. It went right back into solution again. And the white powder and the blue powder, all that stuff disappears. So here's the balance you have to see. You have to get the glass hot enough to be liquid so that you have mobility of these monatomic atoms, these ormus atoms, to move back and forth in the glass, because glass is a supercooled liquid, and you want to get the viscosity slow enough so you have atomic mobility. And if you get it too hot, then the glass is a tremendous solvent. It'll dissolve almost anything.
Excuse me, John?
Yes.
Can we make another announcement for people to hit *6 and mute their phones, please?
Okay.
We're getting a lot of noise.
Yeah. Did anyone hear that message?
*6, please.
Hit *6.
You have to use the master mute because people are not cooperating. There's a master mute for the moderator, I believe.
Yes, I can.
How do I do that?
Everybody.
How do I do that?
I think Barry does that.
Barry, you could do it.
I can hear about 30% or less of what he's saying.
Okay, I will go ahead and mute everybody. And if you do want to speak, then you'll hit *7 so that you will be unmuted. Before I do this, I want to announce that this is the largest conference call we've had so far. Right now, at this moment, we have 66 participants.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh,
that's great.
Fantastic.
So congratulations, everybody.
May I announce this, too?
Can you repeat your website, please?
Oh, it's Barry. I emailed you a list of my four websites, and it's on the white gold. Went out to all of the forms.
I just wanted to say something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I can hear everyone but John Malewski. I can't. His voice sort of broken up a little bit.
I'm talking now. Can you hear me now? Is it clear enough?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's just that for some reason your voice kind of breaks up.
The good news is that this call is being recorded, and so you're going to be able to listen to the call if you're an annual benefactor, and so you're going to be able to get it all because we're getting it all. It could be that you're just not getting it all down your phone.
I switched phones. Is it any better now, Missy? Can you hear me any better?
Yeah, that is better.
It is better now? I switched phones. I have.
That is better, John.
It is better now. Okay, you guys okay?
Yeah, that sounds good, buddy.
Okay,
I'm going to mute everybody, but Dennis and myself and John.
Yeah, okay. Now, we're talking about making this gold. While I'm talking about it, I might mention that on that same website that I sent to Barry that he listed, a friend of mine came up and made a video of me for 1 hour talking about making gold and growing gold and the experience that I have and showing the equipment with the microwave and everything. And so if anyone wants to buy that video, there's a group, a company called Partnership with Earth that made this video for me, and they have it available through their website. So anyone could order that. They were originally selling that for $29, but making it available to anyone on this conference call at $20 plus shipping. So that detail of that is on that thing that I sent to get from Barry. Now, I might mention that this is difficult to reproduce, and it doesn't happen early, but now that we got a lot of good alchemists on here, maybe you guys could take off where I left off and continue it and increase the rate and process of making more gold. Now, one of the things I think we need to do, first of all, we need a microwave where we could feedback the temperature. We need an optical feedback, and so we could hold that temperature quite steadily because the temperature microwave heating has a tendency for the temperature to run away. Once it gets hot, it suscepts more, and the more it suscepts, the hotter it gets. And many times I've had meltdowns and burnouts because of that. So we need someone who wants to do this to have the time to know how to make it, an optical feedback for temperature control. And the second thing, it would be really nice if you could have a sweep, if you could sweep the microwave back and forth over the material so you activate the Ormus atoms in the liquid glass and when it's molten and sweep them to one end to concentrate them. And then, you know, sweep them back and forth slowly so they're rubbing against each other and have a greater chance of interacting. And so if we could get temperature control and sweeping and moving of the atoms, we could probably increase the activity of this by hundreds of times. And maybe just instead of getting, well, let me give you a quick calculation. At 15 grams, the largest bead was about a half a millimeter, and there were hundreds of other ones in there. So I calculated that from glass, we were talking about 15 to 25 ounces per ton of gold coming out of container glass, plain, ordinary, everyday, pickle-jarred glass-type material. And I'm sure that's not optimum, but it's there. And so
let me ask you this, John, because you mentioned on the phone to me
that
how the Incas and the Aztecs used to just make gold by growing it.
Oh, yes. I'm gonna get to that aspect. I'm just talking about how I did it in the furnace. But when I was doing these furnace experiments, you know, one of my experiments kind of failed, and I had it in a small crucible, and the crucible cracked, and the glass melted. When I pulled it out, I found the magnetite. Someone's beeping in. Hello. But next to the magnetite was a little piece of this glass that was blue. When I know the glass is blue, that's the blue Ormus material. That's high-quality Ormus in that glass. So I saved that little piece of magnetite, which was basically about a half inch by a quarter inch by 2 inches long, with some of the broken crucible and that little piece of blue glass. I put it in a polyethylene bag, labeled the date, put the date and the number on it. It was in 1999 or something like this. And I put it away 4 years later. And I put it away because of that little piece of glass on the bottom, that blue Ormus. Picked it up 4 years later, pulled it out, looked at it. There were 13 pieces of gold on the top surface, away on the opposite side of the magnetite from that where that blue Ormus glass was. This is my supposition or my analysis of it, that the gold grew on there because of the magnetic energy field set up behind the magnetite by that Ormus glass, that Ormus in that glass. That blue Ormus glass is very powerful. It's maybe very close to the structure of what they call the Philosopher's Stone, because it collected out of the air. Of course, I believe someone wrote this paper that says Ormus is a gas, and that was me. And as a result, I believe the air is full of Ormus materials. It's full of gold, and probably the easiest one to get out of the air is the gold. But it's platinum, palladium, rhodium, and rhodium, all of the other guys, and I'll talk about that later on, how they form azeotropes with these inert gases like krypton and xenon and activate a lot of other stuff. So I pulled that thing out and looked on that website, Ormus is a gas, there's pictures of this, 2.5 millimeters, or about a millimeter and a half somewhere. There was a bead big enough, a little like a football shape, with a little tip sticking out of it, showing that the growth was reaching out and grabbing the gold out of the air. So it's called tip growth, not basal growth. It didn't grow from the bottom up, which you would normally get, and something looking like a mushroom. You get something that's laying on the ground like a football with extra tips sticking out, so it looked like the atoms are collecting on the outside. So I believe this grew out of the air. Now, even though that was in a polyethylene bag, these Ormus atoms of gold are so small they diffuse in and out of the bag, they diffuse in and out of the bottle, they diffuse right through the plastic or glass containers that I make my magnetic water in. And the water gets activated, even though the top is closed. These atoms are very small. As Hutton says, first of all, the nucleus becomes football shape and shrinks down and becomes smaller, and then all the outer electrons disappear and become Meissner fields, or enough of them, so that the whole thing shrinks down, and the atom is significantly smaller, and since there's no chemical activity, it moves around and diffuses around in and out of everything. So the air you're breathing today, everyone now is breathing in and out gold atoms and platinum atoms and rhodium atoms. I don't know what percentage, but there's enough of them in there that, and I think that is the secret to these runners high when they start breathing and running at a uniform cycle, and they're breathing in and out, or mountain climbers high and all that stuff. It's not just the oxygen. It's their body is collecting larger quantities at a certain rhythm. At a certain rhythm, the energy of the rhythm resonance collects these atoms into your system, and you're breathing these enormous atoms full of this magnetic energy, and that activates the spirit and the soul. And also, these yogis sit down and do these breathing exercises, and they end up going into manana or nirvana or whatever you want to call it. You know, they have this spiritual experience that comes from breathing and collecting with this breathing cycle these enormous atoms that are in the air. And so growing gold is a result of that. And not only will you see in my glowing gold thing about the gold itself, but also these white deposits that are seen on these rocks that we see around it. Can everybody hear me okay? Anyone can hear, break in for a second and say something. If not, I'll assume I'm doing good.
You're coming through loud and clear, John.
It's coming in clear. Good deal. Keep me posted, Dennis. And so if you look at that, my website, Enormous as a Glass, the first two photos are the gold that I grew at the higher temperatures. The photo number 3, 4, and 5 are the ones, 6 are the ones that grew on the magnetite. And then when you get into photos number 7, 8, and 9, you see all this white deposit on these polyethylene bags. First of them were done outside, and then later on I did the same thing in my office here. And I'm collecting this white powder out of the air with nothing but distilled water. And underneath the distilled water is the glass that's left over when we do a fire assay. When you do a fire assay, you have a gold ore. And Hudson said this. He says, for every ounce of gold that's in an ore, there's 20 to 50 ounces of monatomic gold. For every ounce of metallic gold, there's a large amount of ormus gold or monatomic gold. And when you do a standard fire assay, the lead picks up the metallic gold that comes out in the cupel, and you get a little bead of gold that's indicating this ore has 1 ounce per ton or something like that. But in addition, all the ormus material ends up in the glass that is used as part of the assay process. Most of you are familiar with an assay process. You start out an assay process, you take 30 grams of ore, and you take 90 grams of a flux, which contains silica and feldspar, other means that things that melt down, and lead oxide that allow the glass to melt, and the molten glass dissolves the ore, and then the lead picks up the metal components, and the metal components, when you finally pour the assay out into a cone-shaped mold, the lead goes to the bottom and forms a lead button containing the metal, a precious metal, but the upper glass, everybody's been throwing that stuff away. That contains all the ormus material because glass dissolves in glass. And Hudson says that if you heat these ormus materials higher up, they become a glass. And so at these high temperatures, we're dissolving that ormus that's in that gold ore that's not in metallic form. And so it's still in this glass. So you take that glass and grind it up to about the 4 mesh or something so that they're finer than 1/8-inch particles and put them in a plastic bag and put that plastic bag out where it rains on it. Or better yet, because you might get contamination, bring it in the house. Get yourself 2 Tupperware sandwich things about roughly 6 inches square. Put the glass on the bottom and put the second Tupperware on top and pour a cup of distilled water on it and wait from 3 to 4 weeks and you'll end up with a white powder on top. And that white powder will have 2 components. One component will have nice rhombohedral calcite crystals and the other one will be surrounded with these very fine crystals of a white powder. And I believe that's the white powder of gold and the other stuff is the calcium carbonate. Now, where did the calcium carbonate come from in my room, in my office, where there's nothing but air in my room? I've done this time and time again and repeated this experiment. And I think the gold forms first, and the gold in that ormus form or partially ormus form has the ability to atomically transfer some of the elements in the air to produce calcium because gold loves to be in calcium carbonate. So it builds its own little, it's like a little beehive. It's building its own little hive structure or what do you call cones to exist because the crystal structure of calcium carbonate is very receptive to holding ormus gold or even metallic. So the gold is captured and converts and builds its own little nest to live in. And so you have about a 50-50 mixture of the white powder. And it's all in that report. You'll see pictures of that. And then if you go outside and walk around any place where you're west of the Mississippi, where in West Texas or New Mexico, Arizona, California, where there's relatively dry rains, you get light rains in it, or you get dews that we can condense out and stuff like this. That's where the ormus gold comes down and then it attracts and produces these calcium things. So you get these calcium deposits on there. And if you go to any of these go to the university and say, hey, I'm going to go to the mineral deposit and bring this rock in. Tell me what that stuff. Oh, that's just caliche. That's calcium carbonate, and that's formed because you have hot springs around there. But I found these on rocks where there hasn't been hot springs around for a million years. And also in road cuts where they have, we live in New Mexico. There's lava flows all over the place. They keep making road cuts through these lava flows. And they make a road cut 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and the sides of these cuts where they freshly broke through these lava are starting to get coated with this white coating on there. So that wasn't, there was no hot spring in where they made that road cut to make this white powder. It's coming out of the air. And that's coming from this reaction of the Ormus gold that's in the air, gaseous form, and that's doing atomic transformation and making its own calcium carbonate. Of course, there's plenty of carbonate. You've got carbon dioxide in the air, so it grabs that stuff, and somehow it takes some of the elements from the air and produces calcium. It's interesting.
Could it possibly be just oxidation of something on the surface of the rock?
Well, there's no calcium in that lava structure.
Uh-huh.
No.
So,
and also, when I did it in my office, only thing that was in contact, the only surface it was in contact, was the top of this Tupperware thing. You get a 6-inch sandwich Tupperware container, you know, that you put your sandwiches in, you send the kids with their lunch in. They're roughly about an inch and a half high and about 6 inches square. I take two of these things, one fits inside the other one, put the Ormus glass on the bottom, the glass left over from the standard assay, and put the other piece on top and just pour distilled water in there, and this stuff grows in there.
Mm-hmm.
As the water evaporates, it condenses into these crystal structures. There's nothing underneath for it to come through. The glass itself usually doesn't have calcium in it. Most of the assay glasses don't have calcium. There's sodium and potassium and borax, low-melting glasses, peroxides, and feldspars and things like this, but fluorine and stuff like that, calcium and silica and all that kind of stuff.
What about something carried in rainwater? Of course, rainwater would be part of the air.
Well, rainwater could have some of that, but there's not much calcium in the air for the rainwater to catch if it's... like a dude,
hey,
you know this. Yes, go ahead. You had a question?
Are you familiar with Lewis Kervran?
No, I'm not. Who's Lewis Kervran?
Lewis Kervran, his book Biological Transmutations touches on exactly what you're saying in that he did some experiments with trees in dirt, which contained very little calcium, and then after a time, as the tree grew, he felt that the plant was transmuting from nitrogen in the air and forming calcium, which occurred in the soil. Nothing was added to the plant but watering it every day, and the water was distilled water, and yet this calcium occurred in the soil after some time of growth, and that was the essence of his book, Biological Transmutation, that the plant was transmuting nitrogen out of the air into calcium. So I'll throw that in there.
That's interesting because, you know, there's two or three of these cases of this stuff. The French did some experiments where they would raise chickens right from the start, and through their whole life cycle, keep them no calcium fed to them at all. When they got old enough to lay eggs, they were laying eggs with calcium in them. You know, so this was repeated time and time again. So that's a good a senior science project or something like this to do things like that. Another thing is some other researchers
That's all I had.
You hear me? Hello. They took.
Yes, thank you. I muted myself.
Okay. Yeah, they took sprout seeds. Regular sprout seeds, and I did a complete chemical analysis of seeds before they sprouted them and found out so much quantity of minerals and so many elements associated with it. Then took some of those same seeds and sprouted them in distilled water. And after 4 or 5 days, when they were about 2 or 3 inches long, they took those things and analyzed them. In all cases, the total amounts that they had were multiplied by 2 to 3 times, and some elements that weren't even there to start with appeared. So the life force is the ability to do atomic transformation. The energy in life and the components, and I think what they're doing, these structures that contain the life, the DNA molecules and everything else, the resonant structures, every plant, everything living has a DNA molecule. Those are resonant structures. They can absorb and collect this energy, and this energy has the ability to work with superlight, and you don't have to have an atomic reactor to get atomic transformation because you're working with energies that are billions of times stronger and more powerful than electrons. That's magnetic monopoles, and it's a superlight energy. These things interact with superlight, and that's where the energy comes from for all this transformation, because this is my own very biased opinion on this stuff, but it might open the door to other people thinking it, and they could see it a little differently.
I can hear a whole bunch of questions coming on, John.
Okay. Well, is that enough for a while there? I think, let me just, we talked about the growing gold in the sun. Oh, one more recent experiment. This is really baffled me. Okay. You still there?
Go ahead.
Okay. We got another hour yet, so let me take 5 more minutes. Recently, for the last 10 years, I've been trying to get a good analysis, because when I saw that one time that rhodium and iridium in the black sands, I said, gee, I'd like to get some of that real metal. I'd like to be able to get some of that stuff and really get a chunk of metal out of this material. So I've been working recently on this and trying to reduce it with different things. And so I was always reducing it with carbon. It wasn't too successful. And then I got the idea, you know, I drink in this water gives me a little intuition. When 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I wake up and an idea, and I go and write it down. And my little inner stink brain said, John, try graphite instead of carbon. Why graphite? Well, what are my only reason I can say, well, graphite won't burn out as much, so it'll stick around and give you a reducing atmosphere a longer period of time. But graphite has an unusual crystal structure. It's a laminated crystal. Remember, Barry, on these groups, we're talking about laminar crystal structures and all that stuff? They have an ability to resonate and hold energies in different forms than the other.
Oh, yeah.
So I used graphite instead of carbon. Now, there was a disappointment. It was good news, bad news. The good news was that later on, I got some real good metal out of it. Bad news was, before I got it, I had to repeat and repeat and repeat, because the lead beads that normally collect the metal that come down into the bottom as a lead button, very little of it went down. Most of it stuck on the flakes of the graphite. The graphite had each little flake of graphite, which is maybe, you know, 2 or 3 millimeters long, had hundreds of these tiny little lead beads all over the surface of it. It was like it had the measles. It was hard and hard to get these. So I would take them off, and I'd try to pour it, and the graphite had such size surface area the glass wouldn't pour. So I couldn't do a standard assay. So I put it back in a pot, and I added more flux, and I put it back in a pot and added more flux. And each time I'd get a little lead bead out of it, and I put that lead bead in the cupel, and I started to get beads out of this stuff of significant size. Instead of 200 or 300 microns, I think if you get a 300 micron, it represents 1 ounce per ton. So if you get a 600 micron, it represents about 5 or 6 ounces per ton. And so I started to get 600 ounces per ton. That's pretty good, because I'm only starting with 3 ounces of 3 grams of material instead of 30. So you multiply that by 10 instead of 6 ounces, we're talking 60 ounces per ton of something that could be rhodium or platinum or iridium. You know, so I had to run that thing 4 or 5 times, and finally I got 6 or 7 yields, and I put all those yields together, add some more lead to it, put it back in the furnace and cupelled it. Instead of getting one bead, usually you get one bead. I got 2 separate beads came out of this thing. Usually they melt the lead. The cupel is like a little dish, so it kind of focuses down to the bottom. You get right in the bottom where the bottom of the dish is. It's a concave, or like a little convex dish. All the stuff concentrates, but we got 2 separate beads. One bead looked like a bundle of grape, about a little shorter than a millimeter in diameter, and each grape was about 1/10 that diameter. And it was so shiny, absolutely most iridescent, shiny metal I've ever seen, and I believe that's pure iridium. And then the other bead was about the same size, but circular, and it had a soccer ball shape. Now, when you do fire assaying, if you're working with gold and silver, that bead always is shiny and has a mirror finish and something. But if you're ending up with a material that has a higher melting point than the lead, which you're cupelling at, higher melting point than that, then you get crystalline structures on the surface, and they look like a soccer ball with measles or something. It's a regular crystal structure on it. You know, looks something like the ball they drop on New Year's Eve. You remember a multifaceted structure? And so I believe that one ball was probably rhodium, and the little circular ones were iridium. And so by the time I finished this, it was getting late, and my wife said, John, come on to bed. You could play with your mad science tomorrow, you know. And so I said, well, I'll weigh them up tomorrow and measure them up and weigh them up tomorrow. So I put them both into a little container that's about 3 times the size of a thimble, you know, a little holds about 10 or 15 cc's of a little glass container, put the top on, put them away. Came back the next morning, the bundle of grapes were gone. They completely disappeared. The other one was still there long enough for me to get a hold of it and measure the diameter, and I weighed it, and I calculated, gee, if this is rhodium, this has got to have a gravity of about 12. Gravity in that stuff was 6.6. How come it's so light, you know? And then the next day, that one disappeared. And I was talking with Barry and a few other people. Says, you know, maybe you didn't convert that completely. You know, when you form ormus, you can have 100% ormus. You could have 100% metal, or you could have 50-50 or somewhere in between. These things were converted to metal, but they weren't completely converted, and they reverted back to the gas and disappeared.
That's someone's going to pay you to develop this process, because rhodium sells about $6,500 an ounce at the moment.
Oh, it's extremely expensive. Iridium, too. And iridium was so beautiful. I know what iridium looks like because I etched a meteorite that has iridium in it, and or etched away all the iron, and you get this extremely lustrous, shiny, super mirror type crystalline surface reflection. So I'm sure those beads were iridium and the other, and they separated because probably one precipitated out first because the melting point of iridium is much higher than the melting point of rhodium. And so they precipitated out first as these tiny little beads, and then the rhodium came out later on. And so they came out of the lead at different solution positions as the lead was evaporating from the cupel or being sucked into the cupel.
Listen,
did you get any pictures? Did you get any pictures, John?
I'm sorry. Start over again. Yes?
John, did you get any pictures?
No, I didn't get any pictures of them. I didn't. That's why I'm trying to repeat the damn process to get pictures of them. I would have loved to have taken pictures of that bundle of grapes because that was the most exciting thing I've ever seen since I've been playing with metals. You know, I have a degree in metallurgy. I have a degree in chemical engineering, metallurgical engineering, and ceramic engineering. You'll see that on my website. So I understand metals. I've been working with metals for years as part of my process and stuff. And, of course, I've been doing this assay stuff for 25 years at fire assay work, so I'm familiar with what it looks like. And when you're getting an assay bead that melts at a higher temperature than gold or silver, you always get this crystalline faceted surface on it. And I know what platinum and rhodium looks like because I've salvaged some of these old automobile catalysts that contain rhodium and iridium. You know, as the catalyst balls and you grind them up and blade them, and I've assayed that stuff, so I know what the materials look like. And I'm pretty sure what Wooly had is rhodium and iridium.
Wow.
And so this is exciting. But then the next day, I repeated it again, and I got one bead that was a third of a gram, and that came from about 7 grams of raw material. If it was from 6 grams, it would have been, if it was from 10, about 5% of it was this bead, and it was a bead about the size of a pea, a small green pea about that size, and it had a lump on the side. So I think this time, both the rhodium and iridium combined, and the lump on the side was the iridium, because it had a little different texture. It was smaller, and it was like a basketball with a baseball stuck on the side of it, you know? That's the ratio of the large and the small beads together. And I weighed that one. I got a good weight on that thing, and my camera wasn't working, but I didn't get a picture, but I got a good weight in it, and it weighed 3.3 milligrams, 330 milligrams, one-third of a gram, and it came out of about 7 grams of black sand. And if that stuff is rhodium, you're talking, you know, 5 to 7% of that black stuff that I sell at $5 a pound. A pound of that stuff is worth $50,000, you know, if it can
repeat
this process. Yes.
Right now, we're about to shut off the free room, so
I would
like to take a question or two from the free room.
I think that's basically what I wanted to tell, that I made this stuff, and this is the process I used. It wasn't wet chemistry. It was high-temperature chemistry. And so this is a different approach that most people are working on, and I wanted to get that information out to everybody. Now, I'm open for questions. Anyone wants to ask questions, if I can answer, if I can't, if I don't understand it, I'll tell you. If it's something I think I know, I'll give you my opinion. Okay? Go ahead.
Any questions from the
floor? John, don't have a question, but you started this off talking about physics and cosmic things. I just wanted to throw a name out to you and to anybody else that found that interesting. Have you heard of Nassim Haramein?
No, I haven't.
It's
Nassim Haramein.
Nassim Haramein. He's just come up with a complete explanation of the unified field theory, finishing
mm-hmm.
Einstein's work, and explaining the force behind the ether. And I think you
mm-hmm.
would find that fascinating, considering
it's
your
probably very similar to my idea. I believe one source, one force. I believe that superlight is the unified field theory, and it explains everything. It explains gravity. It explains inertia. It explains electromagnetic forces. It explains nuclear forces. It explains all the forces. You'll read that in my paper. I didn't want to go through the whole detail on that because we could talk for hours on superlight alone.
Let's just take a question or two from the free room.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Go ahead. Next, go ahead. Anyone else a question?
Free room.
You were going to talk about how an easy way to precipitate almost out of air or water or something like that with magnetite, I believe.
Well, not with the magnetite. I was talking about just getting that Ormus glass and putting that underneath a plastic film or something, or put it in a bag, and then you put distilled water on it, it comes out of the air.
Oh.
That's in that paper, Ormus is a gas.
Oh, okay. Oh, on your website. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions from the free room?
No. And it's interesting, I take that white powder that comes out of there. If you dissolve it in hydrochloric acid, half of it disappears, but the other half doesn't dissolve in acid. So it's not all calcium carbonate. You go ahead. Any questions?
Any other questions from the free room?
There's a young lady trying to get a question in.
Okay, go ahead.
What were you going to say about 2012?
I can't hear you. Speak a little louder.
What were you going to say about 2012?
Oh, yes. It's good you brought that up, but I'm starting on writing a book. And the book is titled 2012 and Magnetic Energy. And it's interesting. A website and an information came to me about 10 years ago. And let me read you the... It's about how to make... Where the hell is it? Trying to get my act together here. But what it is I think after 2012, nothing electrical will work. And I'll give you some of my reasons for that, is that we get a pole shift. We're going to get a concentration of the north and south magnetic poles, so they shift from north to south. The magnetic flux density will increase by millions of times. And it's interesting. I don't know what it was, Black Elk or one of the Native American Indian prophets talking about changes that occur in the later days. He says the barbed wires will melt on the fence. Now, what's going to cause barbed wires to melt on the fence? The same thing they say is that nothing electrical will work, because if you get a northern pal to get a tremendous magnetic flux flash by here like this, it's going to induce current into anything that's got any aspect and that's conductive, and the current will be so high that it'll melt the wires on the fence. And so we got 5 years for that. And that's why my number one drive right now is try to make a magnetic motor, make a magnetic battery, and make a magnetic light. And I'd rather be doing that than selling magnetite. But I sell a little of that, so it gives me some money to buy my laboratory equipment, you know, just to keep the lab going here. But we have to do that, because after the pole shift, if we don't want to end up in the candle and a horse and buggy stage, we can't depend on anything working electrical, no such thing as computers. So all you guys with your BlackBerries and your computers and everything, you better make sure you write everything down that you want to preserve, because nothing, your discs aren't going to plug into anything, because there's going to be nothing to make it work. And that Black Elk wasn't the only guy. Even some of the Virgin Mary presentations with Garabendal of Fatima, they talk about 3 days of darkness, and after that, nothing electrical will work. During the, you know, they're talking about these earth changes or prophecies in Revelation, and also in Matthew 24, you know, the sun will lose its light and the moon will go dark and all that kind of stuff. You know, later day changes and stuff like this. So we're going to go through that damn thing. This planet X is coming, and what's telling me is that if we love Mother Earth and care for Mother Earth and go out of our way to protect her from being harmed, when this planet X comes around here and starts shaking up Mother Earth, Mother Earth will struggle and fight to save us so that it will preserve more of its beings that are on here. And we're not just a bunch of leeches or parasites, but with people that really love and care for the earth. I believe the earth is a living being. I believe the presence of God is in all things. It's in creation. And most of the God energy is in the form of the spirit energy is magnetic, and the body energy is electrical. And I think even in the Bible it says, there's two forms of light. He says in Genesis 3 it says, let there be light. Then in Genesis 13, again it says, then God created the light of the sun and the moon. So the second light is electromagnetic light, is the light that we have of the sun and the moon. But the first light is the light of the spirit. And in fact, in a lot of interpretations of the Bible, it says that God created the spirit world first, which was all in the magnetic field. And I think everything in the spirit world, everything in the psychic realm, and we're on the realm of all this, we're on the edge of all this stuff with Ormus, because we're right on the realm of converting physical matter into spiritual matter, and this all Ormus stuff is almost spiritual in nature in some ways. So the spirit world is magnetic. He created the spirit world first and then created the physical world later on. And man, that's our job, is to live in both worlds. We're so concentrated in the physical, we got to get more concentrated into the spiritual or into the magnetic realm. And that's where Ormus is coming in, and that's where super light is coming in. That's why we got to get more involved in magnetic energy and open up our spiritual aspect so that we could live in the spirit world, because the spirit world is is going to survive this pole shift, and the physical stuff isn't going to do too well. And so things that are more magnetic in nature, we got to learn to work with this Ormus, and we have to learn to work with the magnetic energy. So my goals are to make a little box about twice the size of a cigarette pack that you take a permanent magnet, you plug it in, the light goes on. You pull it out, and the light goes out. And also to make a black box that you could put in your electric car now. Instead of a battery, you take the battery out, you put this black box in there, and you plug into that, and you can run it any time. It's perpetual energy. It's there. We live in a sea of energy, and Tesla did this years ago. And what he did in 1931, he went out and bought a Pierce Owl, one of the best cars at the time. Took the motor out of it, put electric motors on all four wheels, put an antenna up 15 feet high, and it had a chain dragging for about 10 feet long, and put a black box in there that was roughly 20 inches by 20 inches by 40 inches, and that contained what I believe, and I'll explain what I think he had in there. And so and he ran that car from Albany to Buffalo up to 90 miles an hour without a drop of gas. He was just tapping into super light energy. Let's look at something else everyone's familiar with, the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was a box roughly the same size as what Kessler was working with, 18 by 18 by 36, made of gopher wood, which is a high-density balsa wood, lined inside and outside with gold. And so it was a great big capacitor. Now, if anyone has done any work with large, high-energy systems that require large capacitors, when you buy these things and you get them from the factory, there's a sign on it, keep this capacitor shunted until you hook it up. Because if you don't shunt it, if you don't keep it shorted out, capacitors automatically build up a big electrical charge, and you could touch that thing and you're dead. Same thing. The Ark of the Covenant. If you don't have it shorted out, it'd build up a big charge. It would put 50 to 100, maybe 100,000 volts. The thing would glow at night. The presence of God is there. The whole room is lighted up by the presence of God. And a sinner comes up and tries to touch it, a bolt of lightning comes out of God's box and knocks you dead because it's a big capacitor. Tesla understood this. He had large, like Leyden jars. He had gallon-sized jars full of salt water wrapped in tinfoil. And he had rows and rows of these capacitors, charging them up. And what he did, he had a row that would get high charge from the super light energy, and then when they reach a certain voltage level, they would go through an arc and drop down into the next one, and they will from series to parallel, each time they recharge up all these guys in series, it would lower the voltage. And when they would charge up high enough, they'd arc down to the next one, have them in series going all the way down the line to get the voltage low enough to charge a battery, and he ran those DC motors, ran that damn car. And so we don't know the detail of the secrets of how he was able to transfer this energy and bring it down properly, and that's the key that we have to do, and that's super light energy. So capacitors or other shapes and forms that we're going to get into is going to be the key to making this free energy devices that we have, electric cars in the future. In Albuquerque, they're building what they call the Tesla automobile, and the car is going to be pure electrical. It's going to run on a lithium battery, and they run that thing 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, and it could go up to 140 miles an hour, and it could drive for 2 hours just on a lithium battery. So when I'm getting ready with my thing, I'm going to say, what's the size of your box? I'll build you a black box you plug in there, and then you just plug into this thing, and you don't have to charge it anymore, and you don't have to pay for the damn lithium batteries, and you just turn it on anytime you want it. And that's my goal, and we need a crash program. We need something like a space race or an atom bomb program. We need to spend millions and billions of dollars and get this thing solved and start getting ourselves on the magnetic energy kick before we don't have anything.
I have heard, John, that these kind of devices are already being used by NASA to power the spacecraft.
Some of them are. I don't know what NASA's doing, but I know, they have all kinds of batteries in doing those damn things. I don't know what are the free energy batteries. I haven't heard that NASA's making free energy batteries. But if you do, send me the information.
Yeah, now, any other questions? I know there's going to be lots of questions because this is a fascinating material. So pipe up. Start 7. Ask you, and any question you got written down, let's give them to John right now.
Okay, before we do that, while people are unmuting, I wanted to announce the winner of Joe's computer rebuild, and the name of the winner is Kathy Waller.
Wonderful, Kathy. God bless you.
Fantastic. Are you on the call, Kathy? Hit star 7 if you are.
No, not here from her.
She's probably going to get this call after it's been recorded and released. Fabulous, okay. Kathy. Well, this will be emailed to you anyway. So any other questions you have for John?
Yeah, John, could you talk about the Aztecs growing the gold?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what I know about it. Not an awful lot, but it was interesting. I grew that gold a while ago, and I thought, gee, this was really a freak and stuff. And then I tried to understand it was coming out of the air, it's diffusing in and all that stuff. And then I had heard rumors that the Essenes knew how to make gold and make silver in large quantities. And they were sort of either growing them or converting them, you know, using fertilizer and horse manure and all kinds of things like this. And it would take 5 or 6 years, and they were making tons and tons. It seems to be some of the stuff in the Dead Sea Souls talk about this stuff, but that's not published. But then about less than a year ago, I guess it was in the spring, I was down in Arizona, and that's when I met Vinny Pinto. Say hi, Vinny, if you're on this thing here. And we went to talk to a couple of these guys who are selling, you know, distributing magnetite down there. This one fella had some stuff left, and I bought the last that he had. And then I went over to this other guy and got some of his magnetite to see how it could compare. But it was kind of dirty and needs a lot of work and stuff compared to what I have. But I wanted to have it as a backup store. So if somebody really wanted large quantities, I know I could take a truck down here and buy this stuff. If anyone wants to, I'll tell them where they could go. You got to buy a ton of it, or maybe 20 tons, or $20 a ton, and you got to truck it in and out of there. It's down in Arizona, near Florence, Arizona. But it wasn't as clean and clear as often. The stuff's been laying around for millions of years, so the crystals are pretty well broken up. So I figured, well, the stuff I got, I could make and distribute enough of what I have, and if I don't get a big rush on it, because my stuff comes right off of the mountain. A mile away from where I live, the mountain goes up to... I live at 6,262 feet elevation, and a mile away, the mountain goes up to 11,000 feet, and it's all granite, and 2 to 5% of that granite mountain is magnetite, and as the mountain weathers and comes down into these arroyas are full of these sand and gravel breaking down, and after heavy rains, the light sand washes away and leaves these black streaks, and I climb down into these arroyas and get that sand. And a lot of them still have, if you look under the microscope, one out of a 50 or 100, you can see a triangular face, and every once in a while, you could even see a pyramid, because the crystal structure of magnetite is octahedron. And it's two pyramids base to base, and every once in a while, you see a few of those guys. And so the rocks scratch up and break up all the crystal faces, and I think the crystal structure in those crystal faces happens to make my magnetite give it a little extra jazz than stuff that's been out weathered for a million years down in southern Arizona, where the mountains are already gone. There's no remnants of those mountains that were there, you know, 20 million years ago. So that's where we were on that thing. So I don't know how I got off on track. For a minute, my mind is lost. What was I just...
You were talking about growing gold, the Aztecs and
oh,
gold.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I got to talk... I found the information. I was talking to these old-timers down here. And this one guy was telling me, you know, he says that a lot of people don't realize that the Aztec or the Incas, both of those guys, he says that when the Spanish came, they said they captured their leader and said, look, fill this room up with gold or we'll kill your leader, whether it's Montezuma or this other guy down in Pizarro was down in the Inca thing. No problem, we'll fill the room up with gold. And so they filled the room up with gold, and the Spanish took them away, and of course that gold got them in a lot of problems later on and stuff. But they was wondering, how come these guys aren't bashful at all about giving away all this gold? You know, because they have no problem. And then, of course, the Spanish looked all over. Where are their gold mines? Where are they getting all this gold? They never found any really strong, high-quality gold mine, either in Peru or in Mexico at that time. And of course, these guys were growing the gold. They knew the secrets of how to grow gold. And so they could make gold anytime they want. So there's no problem. We need it? Well, we'll just go out and make some more. You know. And I heard it from that source. And then 2 weeks later, from a completely independent source of that, I got the same story from another fellow who lived in Arizona but lived up in the mountains, you know. It was interesting that I get two completely independent sources saying the same thing. You know?
So did they just grow the gold and throw it in the microwave? And
oh, no, no. No, they didn't have any microwaves. These guys... You know, my gold didn't grow in a microwave. The gold that actually grew on the surface just laid on my desktop here for 4 years in a plastic bag. What caused the growing, I believe, is that we had that piece of Ormus glass underneath the magnetite, and the Ormus glass focusing and concentrating its magnetic energy through the magnetite captured this stuff out of the air and drew it down to the surface and converted the air molecules of gold, or the gold molecules are in the air, into solid metal.
Wow. So how do you think that they concentrated it?
I don't know. I have no idea. I just heard that they did do that. But all I know is that maybe they have some, a lot of volcanic glass has ormus in it. You know, probably obsidian. Maybe they took obsidian and laid that in beds in something like that. And then they took some of their more paramagnetic volcanic oil, some of the lava on top of the obsidian, and layered those things. They might have found that when a lava lays on top of obsidian glass under certain conditions, gold might grow. Maybe probably it was an accident and they discovered it. But you know, I'm trying to think of what we know that lava, that obsidian contains glass. Let me give you another story. I didn't tell you. Most of the magnetite I have is 100% magnetite. I have two or three sources of 100% magnetite. Well, if you analyze it, it's, you know, practically, if you get all the sand out of it. But there's a place where I bought some magnetite, picked them up, and...
Could you repeat that?
It's only about, you know, somebody's beeping, about 50% of it is magnetite, and the other half is glass. If I heated up bubbles and foams over, you know, to get all the gases out of it, it was probably some kind of a volcanic glass. But if I send it out for analysis, there's nothing but... glass constituents and magnetite. So 50% is magnetite and 50% is a glass component similar to volcanic glass. But if I take that stuff and put carbon in it and put it in a microwave or heat it up in a furnace and reduce that, we get a tremendous amount of silver, talking 400 to 500 ounces per ton out of this stuff. And I think the ormus is loaded, the ormus glass is loaded with ormus silver. There's no gold in it, but ormus silver, tremendous amounts of ormus silver. I get bead after bead, the whole bottom of it, of that thing. In fact, if you look on that website where I talk about buying that video, on the front page of that video, there's a picture of me, and there's a picture of some gold that was grown, and also you're looking down into the top of a crucible. In that crucible, there's about 20 or 30 beads, maybe even 50 beads, and they're all silver beads that came out of just a tiny amount of that black sand.
Would you repeat how to get that video again, John?
It's on that website that Barry put on. Barry, will you explain that to him?
Well, I sent out a link on all the forums the big forums, to this website. So just click on the link. It'll be probably the bottom link on that page that I sent out
Okay.
for the video.
And so what that has is my four websites, and it also has three book references. One of them is called Shape Power by Dan Davidson. Another one is called, and I might talk a little bit about this because I want to give one more of my philosophies on this thing, and it's not strictly mine. I want to talk about the book Man, Minerals, and Masters by Charles E. Littlefield, who was published in 1928. And he talked about how you use your mind to control matter. But let me make one more statement first. And the secret, the alchemists, a lot of people, you're never going to find in a book. When you find these things, alchemists write their formula down, how to make the red lion or the green lion or this bang or that thing or that process and that process. They never say that the alchemist is part of the process. So it's your thought, your feelings, and your emotions that affect the process as much as it gives you, that affects the results that you get. A lot of people don't realize that alchemy is partly responsible for the success of perfect alchemy. And the mind of and the emotions and feelings of the alchemist is part of the process. Danae talks about this when she's making her water. If she has a bad day and feels down in the dump, she can't make her electric water from her process because... And some people who are making these Joe cells, if they say if they're not feeling right, the Joe cell doesn't work. We're on the fringe where people don't realize, and especially it's being magnified now with what's happening in the sun. The sun is sending out much more powerful magnetic energy waves in forms and stuff that they never measured, and allowing creativity. The good things are happening faster. The bad things are happening faster. The good are getting gooder. The bad are getting better because there's more magnetic energy available for creation, either positive creation or negative creation. And so as you think and as you work, you create these things happen. In this book, Man, Masters, and Minerals, Charles Littlefield talks about the 12 body salts that we have, you know, the carbonates, sulfates, and all that kind of stuff. And he put these salts on a slide, make a little solution of them, put them on a glass slide, put them under a microscope, and he would say a mantra and think of the letter A, and the salts would crystallize as the letter A. Then he would think of these salts, put a salt on it and crystallize, and think of the letter B, and he'd get B. And he did the whole alphabet just by thinking and saying these mantras during the crystallization process, showing that your mind and your thoughts and your words and your emotions can affect these cell salts. And these cell salts are the key salts that are in your body. So if the salts in your body can be changed by your thoughts, this is the whole thing of, man's responsible for his own health with what things he thinks about. And also, what's affecting matter and the formation and the movement of atoms, that's being part of the process. And so we have to work on more of that and try to develop positive thoughts as you're doing this, work on this kind of stuff and things. And so I recommend everyone get that book if you can. It was out of print. It was reprinted again by Sun Publishing in Santa Fe. I think I gave that reference there. And he talks about making these little mantras to say along with these changes that you want to occur. And so your thoughts and your ideas and your vibes affect all this stuff. So the alchemist is part of the process. Remember that.
Hey, John, you just brought up a really fascinating subject. I'm going to quickly tell you a little story here.
Go ahead. I've
done a lot of work on doing the vibration of the place where I live in, so it's really quite fantastic. And I've had a couple of people come and stay here, a couple of friends who wanted to come and stay, and I said to them, look, if you don't raise your vibration personally to the vibration of this place, it will kick you out. Will reject you, and it may sound or it may feel like to you that you reject yourself, but effectively the place will repel you. And that's exactly what happened with both those people in a fairly ugly way. And what I'm saying is that what the remark that you just made, that the more you have of possibly what you'd call your super light energy is in a place, the more polarized that people get around it. And if they're going to go to the dark side, they'll go there fast. If they're going to go to the light side, they'll go there quickly. But people are going to separate, they're going to choose, and they're going to go in the direction they're going in, and so that helps me to understand what in fact actually happened here.
That's right, exactly. There's energy available for creating, and they say the hours of time for greater manifestation. You keep hearing that time and time again, and the manifestation is coming because there's more magnetic energy available, and the trick is to use your mind and your heart and your soul in a manner to direct that for positive. Otherwise, you could get yourself in hot water a lot faster. You get yourself in trouble quicker, but you can get yourself out of it and do more exciting things. Like I've been trying to make that rhodium and iridium out of that material for the last 10 years. In the last 2 weeks, I got it. The energy is more available for this stuff. It went and disappeared. I don't know how to hold it, but next time I get it, I'm going to try magnetic field. I'm going to try cooking it. I'm going to try other things. And I think eventually we could work it down to where we could hold this stuff, where we learn it. And also, that goal that I grew years ago, where I tried repeating and it didn't work for years, now I'm going to go back. Now that I know that we can maybe throw graphite in there, or we could throw carbon, or we could throw sulfur in there, maybe that glass will convert even faster. And it won't be so tricky anymore. So as we learn these things, we could feed back into the process and try to upgrade the whole thing. That's why I can't do it all myself. That's why I'm giving this information as much as I can to everybody. If you want to, get the videotape and watch it. And say, maybe you could add something to it to bring it out, and there'll be enough money here to support Barry and everybody else, and we can set up a research center to make all this magnetic energy and stuff, whatever we need.
It could have been the Mayas and the Incas had a technology of increasing the electromagnetic field or the energetic field in which this gold actually grew quickly.
Or maybe they also get around to it and chanted and send good vibes to it. You know, they knew that they would get the priests to get out there and say, okay, you guys say this and do this and think this and pray over it and chant over it and come back and visit every once in a while and send that positive. See, the body could generate, your emotion can generate magnetic energy, and magnetic energy is the key to make all this stuff work. And it focuses super light, and you get atomic transformation and all that kind of stuff.
Idea is gold.
Go for gold, man. But I love that iridium. God, I'm still kicking myself for not even taking a picture of it. I wanted to take a picture of it. But, it's getting late. You got to come to bed. You got a big day tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I never thought it was going to disappear on me. It was such a beautiful little bundle of grapes. So about 20 or 30 of these things, maybe 100 microns in diameter, and the whole length of it was about 1,500 microns, about a millimeter and a half, a millimeter and a quarter or something like that. Beautiful.
I can hear people busting to ask a question, so come on, bust in.
Okay, go ahead. Anyone else with the questions?
I have an observation and a question.
Sure. What's your name?
This is Rich in Buffalo.
Okay,
and,
Rich in Buffalo. Go ahead.
Based on what you were just saying, it sounds like instead of thinking of thinking of dark energy or dark matter with such terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you know, if we changed our thought about it, and so that consciousness and energy will be one and the same, we think of it as light, I think that would be a very positive thing culturally as well, in addition to the effects that you're talking about, where you can actually create gold out of thin air, I guess, and water.
Well, you know, it's not thing; it's in the air to start with, but I never called it dark energy. I never call it dark matter. I said the physicists call it dark energy, dark matter, because they don't understand it. They don't understand
right.
why that works, so they gave it. I say it's super light, and super light is the brightest and whitest light, you know, and black holes are not black holes. They're radiant beings of super light, and we're radiating
mm-hmm.
all this energy out and producing all this information, I mean, all this energy about, and that the what scientists can't understand, if, for example, where that energy dark matter came from is that Dr. Rubin from the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., she's an astronomer, and she made calculations and says, you know, I can't understand the stars, the outer stars in these whirlwind galaxies are going too fast to stay in orbit. There's not enough gravity there to hold them in because when you calculate the mass of everything else, they're traveling too fast to stay in orbit. So she says, there must be something called dark matter in there that has extra gravity that's pulling this stuff in. So they invented something. They couldn't understand why that's working. According to my theory, there's no problem. There's more super light energy pushing on the stars than the outer one. As you go further, you go in more and more into the center of the spiral galaxy. They're shading each other, so there's a gravitational gradient from the inside to the outside. So the gravitational forces are much stronger outside than they are inside, and you don't need to create, you don't have to invent something called dark matter to hold this thing together. It's the same thing with the physicists. They don't understand what keeps the protons together because they're all positively charged. How come like charges don't repel each other and the whole nucleus fall apart? So they invent something called a gluon. They say, well, we don't know, but there must be a particle, an invisible particle called a gluon, and that glues it and holds all these particles together. But it's so simple. If gravity and radiant pressure are caused by super light, the super light interacts much stronger with the protons than it does with the atoms because the atoms are so open in structure, so that the radiant pressure of super light is more than sufficient to hold those protons together, and so it's just radiant pressure holding those guys in, and you don't understand what's going on. They invent something like a gluon or dark matter or some other stuff like this, but super light solves all these problems.
Spooky action at a distance.
I can't write a paper on astronomy because I'm not an astronomer, and they won't never get in a journal. I can't write an article on physics about the atom structure because I'm not a physicist. That's the problem. If you're not, everything is controlled by their own group, and they won't let anyone else come in and say, here's an idea for physicists to look at, but I'm a chemical engineer. They won't even look at it. You're not a physicist. How dare you say this? You're not an astronomer. How dare you say this? You know, it's peer review, and if you're not one of the peers, you're out of it. But I don't care. All I know is anything I think about, I'm giving it out. And if I learn how to make these black boxes, I'll put it on the internet and give it to everybody. I learn how to make a matchbox light that works by just putting magnets in it. I'll give it to everybody because I believe in giving and receiving. And the more you give, the more stuff is going to come from somebody. You give to somebody else, somebody will give to you. I believe that. Another thing I believe is that nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And the idea for making magnetic energy is here, and the idea of Ormus is here, and they're all related. The idea of super light is here, and that we're going to get all the support. If I need $50 million, I'll get it. When the time is right for me to have that, whatever money I need, whatever people, I've been in contact recently with four or five really great people that are excited about this idea of magnetic energy, about magnetic monopoles, about all this, trying to solve these problems here, and really people that understand even better than I do. But that's part of the team we need to make this whole thing work. The glue is out there. I'm sending out to the universe. Bring in people and money and ideas to make this thing work. If you want to save this planet of yours, Mother Earth, send the right people. Let them all get together, you know.
Hey, John.
Yes?
I know you're only 80 years old at the moment, and you got quite a lot of time to get this whole thing done.
Right.
But I'd like you to talk a little bit about your own personal vitality as, you know, as your 80-year-old.
About myself?
How you're affected by the water that you make.
Okay, a little bit. Just a minute. I'm taking a little sip of this, what I call Starbucks for the soul. I just gave myself a shot of that magnetic water. So I'm in good shape now, kid. Yeah, my birthday in November was my 79th, so I'll be 80 the end of this year. And I'm still full of piss and vinegar and running around and doing pretty good stuff. And I no problem with the mind. It's working good. Of course, my wife thinks, you know, I'm nothing but an absent-minded professor. Well, that's good. That means I can focus on certain things and I leave the rest of the world out there. It doesn't bother me. I can concentrate on what I'm doing, et cetera.
But John, you're going in and out with your volume at the moment.
What's this?
Your volume is going out. Is it just my phone?
No. Am I breaking up? Am I breaking up? You're losing me?
You were just going up and down on your volume. And I just
Okay. Maybe I was moving the phone a little bit. Is it still okay now?
That's good.
Okay, good. Okay, so here I am in Albuquerque, and what it is, my wife and I just celebrated our 20th anniversary. We were old high school sweethearts. We went together in 1947. We dated. We dated for 4 years, from 47 to 51, and I took her out to Notre Dame when I was getting my undergraduate in chemical engineering at Notre Dame. We went to the football games and all that kind of stuff. We broke up in his senior year, and we each married other people. We both were married for 32 years, and both were widowed after 32 years. So for 4 years, I went to what they call the dark night of the soul. I was pretty busted up. At that time, I was working at Los Alamos when my first wife died. She was killed in an automobile accident with her mother. So we had two deaths in the family at the same time. I was pretty broken up. I had a 13-year-old son I had to raise all by myself and stuff. And so, but within 4 years, my old high school sweetheart lost her husband 4 years later. And we got back together again. So we just finished celebrating our 20th anniversary. So we each were married for 32 years, widowed after 32 years, and then got back together again. So I was broken up there for a while, but while I was then, I was consulting all over the world. I went to Japan, I went to Canada, I went to places all over. I went to California quite a few times and consulted with Hughes Aircraft and basically every major corporation, Phillips Petroleum, Exxon Research. And
John, I have to ask you again.
Sure.
I'm not sure if you're on the right phone. Now, let me ask the rest of the group. Can you hear John consistently the whole time, or is it just me that's getting a huge up and down in volume?
He sounds good.
You sound good? Okay. Well, maybe I'll try to keep it close. I have a tendency to move the phone, and maybe it gets away from my voice, and I'll put my hand up in front to reflect the voices back into it again.
There you go. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah,
Richard in Vancouver Island. I can hear you fine, and Dennis fine, but Dennis sounds like he's a little bit farther down the end of a big long pipe.
Probably.
But, you're coming through nice and even and loud and clear in Vancouver
Probably
Island.
A secondhand satellite that we're using war surplus secondhand electrons transmitting to. You got to convert from electromagnetic radio to magnetoelectric radio. In fact, I may bring that up as another point. In the future, when we want to travel in space, the only energy you need to do is you make yourself a super light solar collector. And then wherever you go, in any place in the universe, we have all the energy we need. And I think that's the energy that these UFOs fly on. They all talk about their energy is magnetic in nature, and that's where it's coming from, and things like this. Another thing is the speed of superlight being 20 billion times faster than the speed of light. We have this galaxy that we live in called the Milky Way. It's about 100,000 light years from one end to the other. If you want to call up a guy on a telephone and send a radio message to a guy on the other side of our galaxy, it's going to take you 100,000 years over and 100,000 years back, even at the speed of light. But at the speed of superlight, it happens in 3 minutes. And then the nearest galaxy, the galaxy of Andromeda, is about 10 times that, so you only have to wait 30 minutes to get there. And if you want to go to the end of the universe, which is 10 billion light years away, it only takes you a year because you're traveling 10 billion times faster than the speed of light. So superlight is going to give us the energy, the speed, and the communication for deep space travel. It's going to give us the ability to travel any place in the universe. It's the energy of the future. We're limited now, you know. First we were limited by the speed of sound, then we're limited by the speed of light. Now we're not going to be limited because the speed of superlight is 10 to 20 billion times faster than the speed of light. And I'm not the only guy saying this. There was a conference recently where 20 of the world's top physicists got together, and they wrote this book, Gravity is a Push. And the speed of gravity is not 10 billion times faster, it's 20 billion times. And they can calculate that with astronomical observations of these eclipses of these taking place of these different galaxies out there and stuff. So it sort of confirms what I've been saying right along, that whether it's 10 billion or 20 billion times, it's very fast, and we have a new source of energy, and we have a lot more energy. And I believe that the energy of the electronic, the magnetic monopole, is also in that same order to about 10 billion times greater. So in the future, we start making electronic devices based on the flow of magnetic monopoles instead of electric monopoles. Now we're talking energy that's 10 billion times greater we could work with. Imagine computers that work 10 billion times faster than the best one they have now. Imagine all kinds of, you know, you see these space cadet movies, you know, Star Trek and all that stuff. The guy holds in his little hand a little phaser or laser, and he could bore a hole in a wall 10 feet thick, you know, something like that. And the energy is right there because it is there. The energy of super light, we learn how to make room temperature superconductors and be able to capture this energy. You'll be able to make any kind of thing you want out of it because there's no limit. It continually reinforces itself. Same thing with making magnetic motors. One of the things, once we make a magnetic motor, this book that I got talks about it. It says once you turn these motors on, you got to keep them going and they'll go forever. And you have to put a load on it. You have to draw energy out of it. If you're drawing energy from the universe, you draw energy, use it up, and feed it back into the universe, and it never runs out. So you turn these motors on, they never turn off. And so we'll have an infinite supply of energy when we do this. And this is why I'm willing to work with anybody anytime and give whatever information I have. I'm making these magnetic motors, magnetic lights, magnetic batteries, whatever else we need, because we got to get our show on the road here because we don't have a lot of time left. And I think
I heard a question coming in. Who was that?
Sure, go ahead.
Hello, John. This is Michelle. I have a question about using some of what you talked tonight on a personal physiological level. The magnetic water, of course, is one of the things that you brought about. Is there anything else that would work on a physical level that would help us with these new energies coming in?
Well, let me think about it. You know, I'm not a hands-on healing type of person. I don't have a acupuncture or a massage label, a thing like that and stuff like this. But, you know, a little thing, what I learned from a massage person is that if you get aches and pains, put little magnets on it. In fact, I use these little dot magnets all the time, and I'll put that reference on my website next time, that if anyone has any joint pain, you put these little gold-plated dot magnets, about 9,000 Gauss. They'll live 40 times their own weight. They're only about an eighth inch in diameter, 16th inch thick, and they'll live 40 times their weight. They lift up knives and forks and every damn thing else that you put them on your fingers. And they're very good for pain. Magnetic energy is very good for pain and also improves circulation. That's just another attribute. That energy of the magnets, I believe, comes from super light energy.
Where do you get those magnets, John?
I'll give everybody an 800 number right now. Hold on one second. There was a write-up in Reader's Digest about 4 or 5 years ago, and they said, let me read this, what it says here about magnets for pain. And this is very good for everybody, because every one of you guys are going to get older, and when you get older, you get more pain and every damn thing else. And this was a study was done at Boston Medical College and in the Institute of Rehabilitation. They were had people rank their pain from 1 to 10 points on sensitive muscle areas that they touch. Small magnets or placebo devices were put on the participants, were taped on their area and left there for 45 minutes. When we moved, the patients were asked to gauge their pain. 22 out of the 29 patients treated with real magnets reported improvements compared to 4 out of 21 treated with dummy magnets. Furthermore, the decrease in pain in the score was 5 points among those who received the magnets, but only one out of the placebo group. What they're basically saying here is that magnets seem to reduce pain. Now, let me give you a little story about magnets and pain and stuff like this. I broke my toe about 5 years ago, my little toe on my left foot, and I had a black and blue mark on there about 2 inches in diameter, and it pained and everything. I went to the doctor and x-ray, there's a little crack in there, just leave it alone, take a few aspirin for the pain, it'll grow back. And so after a day or so, I said, John, for God's sakes, put a magnet on it. That magnets are good for pain. So I had a magnet, one of these Japanese magnets. It was about the size of $0.50. It didn't quite cover the whole pain area, you know, the black and blue area, so I taped it on overnight. In the morning, I came and I took it off. Where the magnet was, all the black and blue was gone, and the pain was gone. But I had a crescent moon of black and blue, which was left that wasn't covered by the magnet. So the magnet improved circulation so much, it flushed out all that dead blood, it got circulation going, and reduced the swelling and the pain and all that kind of business. Significant effect. In a way, I think this magnetic energy...
And you didn't take a picture.
Of before and after? No, I didn't know what was going to happen.
Or even after.
Take the pain away. You know, but it was interesting. About
is it
3 months
which
later,
pole, north or south to the skin?
North pole, always north pole.
Okay.
Let me give
what
you
mean,
800 number, okay?
What do you mean by north pole? Just a minute.
You use the north magnet pole that's on the magnet to put against the skin.
How do you know it's north? The north pole?
Well, the magnets I buy have a dot on, and the dot represents the north pole. You buy these magnets from this company. I'm going to give you the name for it. because I don't make these magnets, and I don't tell whether it's north, whether it's a north seeking pole or north biological pole. There's always a question there.
And but, you can always use a compass, and that'll tell you.
That's right, exactly. But let me give you this number, okay? The company is called LHASA, L-H-A-S-A. OMS, that stands for Orthopedic Medical Supply. And here's a toll-free number, 1-800-722-8775, the catalog. And when you get their catalog, you order these magnets. These are the ones you buy. They're called Accuband, A-C-C-U-B-A-N-D, 9,000 GP. That means gold-plated, okay? They're gold-plated so that they won't rust. And look, the magnets never wear out, but you lose them once in a while. So when you buy the magnets, they come with these little circular adhesive patches, about 3/4 inch in diameter, and the magnets themselves are about a little over an 1/8 inch, 1/16 inch thick. They're nice little magnets. You put them right where there's pain, whether it's your elbow, your fingers, your joints, your back. They work wonders on the pain. My wife gets stiff neck all the time. She puts them on, and it takes the pain away, too. I have them on my thumb once in a while. I have them on my elbow, my knees. When you get older, you start to get joint pain, and this is extremely good. So you buy, they're called the high-quality plasterers. These are extra little adhesives, 20-millimeter adhesive patches, and you buy 10 sheets of those, and each sheet contains 12 of these little patches. And when you put them on, you always put them on so that the dot shows toward you. So when you pick up the adhesive and put it on your skin, the dot, which is the North Pole, goes to where the pain is.
And
these Accuband runs $21 for a package of 12 and $8 for the other. So about $30, including mailing, you got enough stuff to take away a lot of pain. And you can put them in clusters. Don't put them any more than a 1/2 inch close to each other because they jump and stick on each other. But the magnets never wear out, but sometimes you lose them. And then you're going to like this stuff so much, you're going to buy these things package after package, and you give them away to people, you'll be a hero, because there's nothing better than helping people out of pain, and it really
will help the pain of if you put them in your back pocket with your billfold.
Yeah,
it will help the pain of running up the bill on your credit card.
Yeah, because what it does is strip the numbers off your credit card.
There you go.
And you can't use it anymore. It helps that
good
pain.
Point.
You're very good, Barry. So you keep them away from your billfold if you don't want to lose up your credit card. Or if you have one on your finger and you go in and you're on a motel, you're traveling and you go in a motel and you pick up these cards that you zip in to go in and out of your door. I had that happen time and time. The zipper is lost on your door opener because it affects the magnetic readout on those damn door openers, you know.
There you go.
So that's really good stuff. So magnets really great, good, and improves. Let me tell you another way I think it helps with circulation. You know how you generate electricity? You run a conductor through a magnetic field, and it develops a charge in that conductor, right? That's how electricity is generated. So your blood is a salt solution. It's an electrical conductor. So if you put a magnet on your skin, and the blood is circulating underneath then, that electrical conductor, which is your blood, is getting electrically charged. Now, if you put it right over where there's pain and there's swelling and the circulation is poor, the blood starts going to... One of the problems with what happens when you have an injury or something, there's a swelling and the capillaries get smaller, and as a result, some of the blood corpuscles stick together, and in a group of two or three, they don't go through those tiny capillaries. And so if you put a magnet on there, it charges up the capillaries, they separate, like charges repel each other, they separate, the viscosity of the blood goes down, the circulation increases, it goes through those tiny capillaries, it flushes out the dead blood, flushes out the waste products, swelling goes down, and pain goes away. So that's my interpretation of how it works, and it's just plain everyday physics of generating electricity. It's a conductor running through a magnetic field, and charging up the blood, separating the corpuscles, and the corpuscles, when they're not clustered up, the blood flows a lot easier, and it's circulation. That's why everybody put heats on things with pain to try to improve circulation and stuff, you know. They put cold on to numb the nerves, but they put heat on to improve the circulation.
John, this has been such a fantastic call, and we're running out of moments.
Okay.
We're going to take another couple of questions before we shut this baby down, and we're going to have to have you back as a guest, because you've got far too much information to pack into a 2-hour call.
Yeah,
so
that's all right.
Ask a couple of questions before we pull the plug on this thing.
Okay. Anyone have other questions? Go ahead.
John, this is Rich again. The water you're drinking, is that what Vinnie Pinto calls the meow water?
Yes, he called it meow water. I never made that name up, but he did. Yeah, magnetically energized Ormus water, meow, that's where it comes from, where the word comes from. Recently, I've been calling it Starbucks for the soul because, you know, the spirit is magnetic. You got to get magnetic energy into the spirit. All healing and regeneration takes place in the spirit first. Otherwise, it's not permanent. If you don't heal the soul or the spirit first, the body doesn't stay healed. And so that's why this stuff is such an important part of the healing process, this stuff, a regenerating
now,
process.
The water you're using, is that right from the tap or is
it's right
purified
from the tap. We live,
somewhere?
In Albuquerque, we have our wells. They go down 2,000 feet. The water is 7 million years old, and it's some of the cleanest and best water. But when anyone, you could go to buy Arrowhead spring water, any kind of water that you normally drink anyway, you could use in there. Lots of times I use I use Arrowhead water, and just any good spring water, anything that you normally would drink, put in there, and it activates that water. Leave it in for about 3 days with that magnetic energy, and it does a pretty good job.
Have you ever heard of using ceramics with water, like the prills and the ceramic beads?
Oh, yeah, someone makes these things they call, baby star babies and some of these ceramic balls and other things. Some of those things are good. I don't understand how those ceramic balls and things work. I understand more of how the magnetic energy. And here's another point I want to make to get across to everybody. People call me up and say, John, why don't you just put magnets on the side of your bottles and stick them in there and see if that works? I said, well, maybe it would work, but my understanding is what's happening is when you put magnetite around this bottle of water, you don't get a north or a south pole. All you do is increase the Earth's magnetic field by about 5 times. And so we're concentrating the Earth's magnetic field in a uniform manner, and that extra energy in there just activates these Ormus molecules and moves them around. It also activates the water, and the water clusters into octahedrons or dodecas or some other structure. It structures the water, and when the water is in that structured form, it acts as an energy nest, and the Ormus atoms collect in there. And so when you drink them, there's something to hold them in. Otherwise, Ormus atoms are always very fast-moving gases. They're diffusing in and out. They go right through the walls of the bottle. They go through the plastic. They go through the glass. But if they get into the water and find an energy structure like clustered water, it stays in there. And so you accumulate these act as an energy nest to capture the magnetic molecules of Ormus gases. And then when you drink this stuff, it's doing the job for you. Then it's released into the body, and that magnetic energy energizes the spirit, and the spirit sends the energy even in the blood and activates the hemoglobin molecule, and it takes it, spirit aims it at where it needs it most. That's my interpretation.
Are you using plastic? Are you using plastic or glass when you're making your, well,
plastic, you could use glass. I'm half plastic and half glass because the glass bottles are the size are hard to find exactly what I wanted. And I originally used nothing but plastic, and now I've been able to buy larger glass containers that contain this pomegranate juice, and I'm drinking some of that along with my morning water and stuff. And those bottles are just the right size for my larger units. I have a 4x6 units. I used to use 3x5s. And so, because I know the guy who sells this magnetite, I get it pretty cheap. I get a good price on it. So I can make these bigger units recently. Okay.
But John, you just mentioned drinking pomegranate juice, which brought up an interesting subject for me. What's the kind of foods that you usually eat?
Well, my first thing in the morning, again, to be a regular guy, I used to drink plain prune juice, but it was too thick and tasty. So I take half a glass of prune juice, 1/4 glass of pomegranate, and 1/4 glass of aloe vera. You know, as you start to get older, you want to drink aloe vera because that's got some rhodium and iridium in it. And that's for the brain, and it keeps you from getting Alzheimer's. You know, that's one of the things. And then 3-4 days a week, we have our oatmeal for breakfast, you know. And my wife and I, whenever we go out for dinner, we always share a meal, you know. It's because at this age, you want each other to keep the weight down. If you keep the weight down, don't eat too much. Eat enough to satisfy, but not enough to fill. That's the key. Fill a plate, but don't overload the plate. Take just a little bit less. Instead of a full scoop, take 3/4. You'd only have to cut out a small amount. If you get a sandwich, leave half of the top off. You know, just cut down on the carbohydrates, the sugars, and the volume. Just keep the volume down. If you keep the weight down, you'll be surprised. 90% of the problems are cured. If you don't eat too much, the body could digest the food better. And once the food is digested, it's processed, it gets in and does the repair job. But if you overdose the thing at any one time, then it doesn't process properly. You get a lot of gas. You get putrefaction in your gut and stuff. You fart a lot, and you burp a lot, and all that other kind of stuff because the food isn't being processed properly, etc. And so the trick is, and don't eat too many crazy things. Of course, my wife has one glass of wine a day, and I don't drink anything. And that total level of that, none of us smoke, and I never smoke. My father never smoked, and I think so. I don't drink it, don't smoke. But,
great advice, but now I want to ask for one more question, then we're going to... They're going to pull the plug on this thing.
Okay.
John, this is...
Yeah, go ahead.
Richard from Vancouver Island here again.
Okay, Richard.
I've been batting an idea or two around with when I read your papers on Superlight there, a whole bunch of lights came on. Anyhow, one of the things that I've kind of intuitively come to is that there's got to be some way to affect coherence in Superlight. And,
oh, yeah, we wait.
For, like a laser?
Absolutely. I was thinking if you make a super light laser, boy, now you got it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I know that I'm also kind of familiar with the South American gold-making traditions, and I know a little bit about that just from what I've intuited and gleaned out of the books. But I would consider using a crystal. But one of the concepts that I'm working on, and I think I'm on the right track here, is scalar fields at 90 degrees to each other, like a focal field. And
not over again. I lost you on that.
Okay. What I was planning on doing was constructing a magtet.
Constructing a what?
A tetrahedron.
Oh, okay. Tetrahedron. Okay.
Magtet. Which is, do you know what I'm talking about? The guy from Pal Oil built these things. It's a solenoid wound pyramid structure.
Okay.
And you can get a really nice straight magnetic field out of it. And it's basically a coffee table toy right now. But I'm trying to get the right kind of wire and figure this thing out. And what I'm planning on doing is, if I can get this thing built, to subject it to a high-frequency power supply, maybe even a burst-type, you know, with a few capacitors in there to see what happens. I'm a little bit afraid of it, but the concept what I'm thinking about is that if you could focus field, the magnetic field, and get it tuned just right, you might be able to tap this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, well... I got some ideas on tapping and collecting superlight. You know, if we have room temperature superconductors, all our energy problems are solved because you could capture that superlight like nobody's business, and you could convert it and run it into everything. I think the first experience will be done in liquid nitrogen on this stuff, you know, and because, you know, you saw that experiment where you take a magnet and it'll float and levitate on a superconductor in a magnetic field.
Yeah,
they put liquid nitrogen and the thing floats. Now, if you could just make yourself a cone shape of superconductors, that any superlight that's coming along is going to get focused down the center because its magnetic energy is going to be repelled and concentrated at the base of the cone.
Yep.
So you cut a hole in the bottom of your cone, and now you got a concentrated form of superlight. And, you know,
what would
Wilhelm
you put
Reich
around the cone, John?
Huh?
How would you construct that cone?
Well, that's the thing. You got to make it out of superconductors, and they had to have it in low temperature. But eventually, once we get room temperature, this is where the Ormus materials come in. Some Ormus materials have this superconductivity. I know everybody's been talking about it, but I think if we make cones lined with superconductors, I mean with Ormus materials, we might be able to get a focusing of superlight, and we might be able to concentrate this energy and make some of these motors and things that we're talking about.
Hey,
so
John?
We're very close on some of these ideas. That's why it's good to have a forum like this where everybody throws out their ideas and everybody contributes a little bit, and before you know it, we start putting the puzzle together. Okay?
John, could I offer you something?
Sure.
I had something that just showed up in my email out of nowhere, a document called Magnetic Energy to Heal the Planet. It's a 230-page Adobe Acrobat file.
That's the one I was looking for. That's
I'll
the one
send
I was
it to you tonight.
For.
I'll send
huh?
it to you tonight. I thought
would
that would be right up your alley.
I appreciate that.
I will
do
that.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
That would be great, because I had gotten that years ago, and I lost it when my computer broke down.
Give me your email
exactly
right now.
What talking about. There's 14 devices made out of using only magnetic energy.
Right, a magnetic motor, magnetic light, magnetic water
purifier.
What is your email address?
It's JV.
J.V. Maluski.
At
AOL.com. J.V.
Okay, I'll get it coming to you right now.
Good to you. God bless. Thank you very much. All right, thank you very much.
Can I ask one last question?
Go ahead.
Can I ask one last question? The superconductor inside the pyramid, the pyramids in Giza, they use crystal. They use granite and crystal.
Right.
So might not the superconductors be within the crystal? Which is if
I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
Reverend
room
Mary
temperature
Hardy,
superconducting. So. Nobody's made room temperature superconductors except we have it in our organic structures. The body is room temperature. The hemoglobin and the porphyrin molecule we talked about earlier are superconductors. The DNA molecule is superconducting. They're organic, and I think...
But that's within the silica, that you get from the plants, and you can also get some silica from the quartz sand,
mm-hmm.
the silica. But if it's organic silica within the plants like burdock and horsetail, has the organic...
No, also
silica.
rice contains a lot of silica. The husk of a rice grain is 17% silicon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to suggest here is the quartz sand.
Yeah, right.
Would probably contain a lot of ormus within that structure. If that.
Oh, it does. Oh, I believe
into the fulgonites that you find in the Libyan desert glass, and mm-hmm. line the pyramid either inside or outside with that will concentrate the ormus.
It might be that because they got ormus materials in the quartz themselves and make the glass out of it. Well, that's why I was able to take glass and activate it and get gold out of it, because the gold in the form of ormus.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is what the ancient Egyptians did, or if they were indeed Egyptians even.
Yeah, well, the Atlanteans or anybody else, whoever you want to call them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was built by the Atlanteans. I believe the pyramids are 12,000 years old, not just 3,000.
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. What's your name? Your name is what?
Carolyn.
Oh, Carolyn?
Yes.
Okay, Carolyn. Good deal. Well, Barry, is there any way of getting a list of all these people? Where they're from and emails? It'd be nice if everyone would write it into Barry, your address and stuff on that stuff.
Or you could put it together and ask them to email me
with their name and address. Yeah.
Yeah, just give your email address and they can email you.
Okay, anyone that wants to get in touch with me, keep in touch with me. My email address is jvmilewski, MILEWSKI, at AOL.com. Okay? JV stands for John and Vincent, but jvmilewski at AOL.com.
Loud and clear, John. Could you post that paper to the website or to the forum, the one that you're getting on the magnetic motors, et cetera?
I'm sorry, what?
I was thinking it might save you answering a lot of emails. Could you post that, the
one that guy's sending to me? Yeah, I'll try to do that. It didn't show up yet.
You could go to www.magneticenergy.org, O-R-G, .uk, and it's right there. You could download it as a PDF file.
Okay.
Magneticenergy.org.uk.
.org.uk.
Okay, magneticenergy.org.uk, www. And that's
correct.
That 200-page thing on magnetic energy?
I just sent it to you, John. Don't bother. It's on its way to you right now.
Oh, good deal. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It didn't show up yet, but we'll see what's cooking.
I was typing a little something else in there for you. That's why I didn't send it yet. It's on its way now.
Oh, good deal. Thank you.
Now listen.
Okay. Dennis, cool. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
This call could go all day, and we've all got heaps of stuff to do, and I know I do. So, listen, we're going to have to pull the plug on this, and we're going to have to get you back on another call, John, because...
We'll do that sometime. Meanwhile, I'll try to get my act together, get some more stuff consolidated so people can have all this information more readily available, okay? And don't forget, if you want any more details, you go to that website and pick up that video, and you'll see a lot of stuff in there about how he made that goal, okay? I don't make any money on it, but the guy who spent the money to make that video... he'll get some of his books back. He spent $5,000 on it, I think, for me. Okay. Well, you guys, thanks again. Okay?
Thank you, John.
Before you leave, guys,
goodbye.
Just say goodbye before you... They're all leaving now.